Welcome back to Across the Movie Aisle, presented by the Rebeller Podcast Network. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch, editor-in-chief of Rebeller. I'm joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm well.
Glad to be talking about movies with you guys.
Before we get started, I'd like to discuss Rebeller's first book, They Called Me Wyatt, by Natasha Tynes. You might remember the story of Natasha Tynes, the author who lost her book deal after Twitter's outrage mobs canceled her for tweeting a photo of a Metro employee eating on a train. After she lost her book deal, Dallas Sonnier reached out and rescued her novel from the ash heap of history. If there's anything Rebeller stands for, it's saying no to the perpetually aggrieved. That flamethrower at the start of each show is wielded by Dallas and aimed right at the heart of phony outrage. They Called Me Wyatt is available now in paperback and on Kindle at Amazon.com and via ebook from Google. All right, first up, in controversies and controversies, Saudi Arabia seems to have decided that the future is people getting together in enclosed spaces. Seems odd. Seems like some odd news out of the oil-rich kingdom, which has invested heavily in recent weeks in both Live Nation and Carnival Cruises. There are a couple of different ways of looking at this. On the one hand, both Live Nation and Carnival have seen their stock prices take a big hit as a result of coronavirus, and oil prices have also taken a big hit as worldwide travel has plummeted. Is this simply an effort to diversify the kingdom's holdings at a discount? Or is there reason to be concerned about this, Alyssa? I mean, do we really want a nation whose views on freedom of expression are, at a bare minimum, shall we say, backwards, taking a heavier stake in cultural products like concerts and cruises?
Look, I think I am especially not a fan of Saudi Arabia, considering that the kingdom murdered one of my coworkers a couple of years ago. But yeah, I think it's intensely worrying to see America's cultural industries, although I'm not sure the cruise industry actually counts as Americans, yeah, given how many of those companies charter themselves under different flags to not have to pay taxes in the United States. But I don't think it's fantastic to see more American cultural industries become more dependent on the, you know, investment funds or the censors of totally autocratic nations that, you know, may have convenient relationships with the United States, but that share basically none of our values. And, you know, I suppose we should be relieved that it's not China, which appears to have a plan for extending its own cultural influence across the world, whereas Saudi Arabia mostly just seems to want to, you know, kiss up to certain U.S. interests without actually doing anything to reflect our values. I think this is a concerning development, though at the same time, if what the Saudis want to do is sink their money into the cruise business, it's possible that that is a investment fund and a business model that deserve each other.
Peter, what do you think about Saudi Arabia?
Yeah, Sonny, I think there's an argument to be made that if you really don't like Saudi Arabia and want them to lose, then this is great news.
Yeah.
Because do you really think the cruise business is coming back? I mean, there's stuff that I think people are going to be ready and willing to do, even if it comes with a risk. I think movies and bars are things that people just really love. I know, obviously, I'm like talking my own book here, but sports as well, right? Like, there are definitely events that people will really want to go back to. And it's not that cruises don't have deep fans, people who really love going on cruises. They exist. But cruises seem like an especially bad bet. They seem like something.
My understanding, though, Peter, is that Carnival released new dates for later in the year, and they sold out immediately, which is insane. Why do you want to go be on a floating death box? And why do you want to pay a lot of money to do it?
I don't
understand.
Yeah, I mean, this is part of my confusion here is that I personally find cruises to be the most grotesque places on the planet. Just like they're you know, every year you get a story about people having like explosive diarrhea across an entire ship, you know, tens to thousands of people, you know, just getting sick and expelling bodily fluids because they're all sharing diseases at the buffets and the cramped quarters. So I am like confused by this in the first place, just on a general level.
And the food is so bad, but at least there's a lot of it.
There's so much of it, and it's, you know, you've, yes, it's granted, it's all bottom left shelf liquor, at the open bars, but you can get real drunk.
There's always like a bottle of Macallan 15 for $50 a pour.
I don't understand it, and but you know, obviously I'm not the target audience here. The target audience though tends to be old people, which is another reason why this is so confusing. I mean, is this just a I don't know. The Live Nation thing is actually kind of more interesting to me because it is the sort of thing that, in theory, is a good distressed asset right now. Live experiences, right, are the things that you can't pirate. They're the things that you can't, replicate in any real way.
And concerts can be moved outdoors. And in fact, the boom in the concert business in the last decade has been festivals, most of which are held in outdoor settings. Now, I mean, part of the appeal of those outdoor settings is that, like, you get really close to people, that there's a huge amount of just sort of, like, physical intimacy and contact, right? That it's just, I mean, it's not quite a cruise ship, but it's bodies pressed up against bodies in front of the stage. But that, while I think that that's part of the appeal, I don't think it's the only appeal, and I think you could find ways to have, I don't know, I mean, obviously, it would be a big change, but I think you could have a Coachella-style event in some ways that people were much more comfortable with. And just because even in relatively close settings, it increasingly seems to be the case that that being outdoors does limit transmission. And so Live Nation may be something that survives here. And it may, and Saudi money may be what keeps Coachella and the American musical, American music festival business alive during what is going to be, let's call it a gap year.
Optimistically, maybe the compromise here can be that Mohammed bin Salman has to spend the rest of his life on a COVID-19 infected cruise ship. This is how we achieve cosmic justice and keep the concert industry alive.
It seems like an unlikely compromise. Look, so I am not a fan of Saudi Arabia's government at all. I mean, they are in some ways even more, I think, condemnable, right, than China, just in terms of how they treat their citizenry and the way they treat the press, right? I mean, they literally murder journalists. They're very, very, very bad. At the same time, they have a lot of money, and their money has been tied up in American enterprise of all kinds for decades now. In particular, in the real estate business, there's just a huge amount of Saudi money kind of floating around. And so if you are working in a big office building in New York or in some other big city, there's a decent chance that there's some Saudi money that was involved in either keeping that building sort of going, right? So they either rent or own a part of it, or they invested in the building of it. They sort of had a financial relationship, I should say, with SoftBank, which was big in
the WeWork debacle.
Right, and the WeWork and all of that stuff. And so as concerning as it is, and I again, I'm not saying that Saudi Arabia is good. I'm not saying that I endorse or condone their governance at all. Their money has been involved in big American business for a long time, and I don't think that this is wildly different.
Right. I just think that there is something different about sort of the culture industry writ large, where one of its sort of propositions, one of the things that it says, regardless of whether or not it's true, is that it is a representation of some uniquely American values in a lot of ways. And
one of those values is taking money from whoever will give it to you.
Absolutely. But to see those industries get tangled up with autocratic regimes is, I think, it's a little different. It's a little worrisome. And part of what is worrisome and upsetting about it is that you end up seeing which artists and which companies are willing to, you know, bow down for that kind of money. You know, when you see a place like Netflix that simultaneously sort of sells itself as a place that gives artistic freedom to people and then censors this en masse to avoid angering, you know, the Saudi government, you know, you see when people show you who you are or who they are, believe them. And the presence of Saudi money and Chinese censors has led the entertainment business to show us over and over again who its executives are, at least. And it's depressing. It's, you know, maybe what is depressing and controversial is less the Saudis making this sort of, you know, making this sort of investment, or the Chinese government making these sorts of choices, than entertainment companies and individual entertainers choosing to go along with them.
So what do we think here? Is it a controversy or a non-controversy that the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia is getting more involved in cultural events like concerts and cruises?
It's a controversy.
I think people could end up treating it as a controversy. I'm not sure. I think it is one right now. I would just note before we finish this segment that if you guys recall about a year ago, even before all of the pandemic stuff happened, the talent agency Endeavor actually had to return $400 million from a Saudi wealth fund or something like that because of pressure on this. And so, you know, there have been connections between Saudi Arabia and the entertainment industry, which just needs a huge amount of capital, often kind of stupid capital, right? Just be willing to risk on whatever. So I don't know. I think it's a non, it's like provisionally a non-troversy, but it could become one.
I think it's mostly a controversy just because I do think that the cruise industry is dying regardless of whether or not people are signing up for cruises immediately, stupidly. The concert thing would be more worrying to me if I ever went to concerts anymore. But since I only care about myself, this does not.
You're not concerned about Jay-Z spouting.
Yeah, I mean, Jay-Z
Saudi
is,
propaganda.
Jay-Z is coming out hard for, you know, I don't even know, following the Quran very closely, I guess. All right, on to the main attraction, Capone.
Attraction?
Main attraction. That's the word that we use, the main attraction. Capone, it's a movie about Alphonse Capone. A title card informs us about director Josh Trank's new picture very early on that this is about his last year of life, very specifically the last year of Al Capone's life, a life that had been ravaged by syphilis and left him demented pretty early on. Capone is played here by Tom Hardy, who takes his obsessions with ticks and accents to new heights in this picture. At no point is he particularly legible in his speech, however, preferring method grunting to speaking. Everything about this movie is something of a disaster, from Hardy's hammy performance to Josh Trank's inscrutable plotting to symbolism that adds up to very, very little. One gets the sense that this is a very personal movie for Trank, who famously drove his career into a ditch while trying to reboot the Fantastic Four movies. But what that says about him is not super flattering, I would say. Still, there has to be something good we can say about this movie. There's something good to be said about every movie, no matter how terrible it is. Peter, throw Capone a little bit of love before we bury it in hate.
A couple things I liked about it. The soundtrack by LP, which I think isn't his best work, is still... it's not his best work, but his best work is absolutely incredible, and it's still kind of an interestingly moody, textured bit of a soundtrack work. It is, I think the movie is technically kind of interesting. Josh Trank, I do think this film is kind of a disaster, but it's like a well-crafted disaster in certain ways. There was a lot of thought put into it. He's like, you see him in every frame, in every scene, you see him trying really hard. And the same goes for Tom Hardy. Tom Hardy's performance is, I don't think it works. I wouldn't call it good, but my Lord, it's really interesting. It grabs you, right?
It's a thing.
It's
something. Yes, it's very committed. And I never thought that I would hear sounds like that come out of a human. So there's novelty value, right?
Sure. Alyssa, what did you make of Capone?
So the comedian Eugene Merman once gave a commencement address at my high school in which he advised the graduates to follow your dreams unless your dreams are stupid. And this movie, as sort of an impassioned statement of Josh Trank's sadness over having ruined his own career, is pretty stupid. It's not good, you guys. It is just not good. And in a weird way, I was kind of vexed about the fact that we were discussing this movie with my pick of the week, since I couldn't see how they could possibly have anything in common. But as it turns out, Capone is a really good example of a movie that is sort of deliberately strange in a way and mistakes that strangeness for sort of insight or transporting ability. I mean, this is a movie where that is literally about Al Capone going insane because he has the clap, that also features Kyle MacLachlan as his personal doctor, basically as if he is one of the duplicates of, you know, MacLachlan's character from Twin Peaks, that wastes Linda Cardellini. I mean, it's so weird. And like Peter said, I can understand that Trank cared about this a lot, but whatever he saw does not translate into the final product in any meaningful way that I can tell. And I think I'm a decent close reader of cinematic text. Like, yeah. I like disasters, right? I mean, I really like Richard Kelly's Southland Tales, even though I think that movie is like very weird and obviously sort of a mess. But whatever is going on for Trank here is sort of so private that it does not seem like he has the ability to communicate it.
Well, there are things that I dislike about this movie just on a technical formal level, like Tom Hardy's performance, which I think is bad. And I don't think works in any real sense of the word, and is too committed to being inside its own head.
I think you just have a really unreasonable expectation that actors should read lines in ways that you can understand.
Right. And Tom Hardy sometimes has trouble with this. He is the master of grunts, but they don't help him here. But it's also bad in ways that I resent in a way. Like, it cheats. The movie cheats. And one very specific way in which it cheats is the treatment of Matt Dillon's character. So in the movie, Matt Dillon plays an associate of Al Capone's who is contacted by Al Capone's wife, I believe, right? Doesn't she call him on the phone and say, "You got to come here"?
He gets a phone call.
All right. So anyway, we see him outside of the world of the picture, and he's getting a phone call, and he comes and he hangs out with Al Capone, and then you realize about halfway through his appearance in this movie that he's not actually there, that it's a figment of Capone's imagination. But you can't realize that. Except for the you, there's no way to read the movie as him not being there the way it's set up. I mean, it's just like the language of the film does not allow you to treat this as like a ghost a la The Shining, right? He's not Lloyd the bartender. He doesn't just kind of show up at the house. He's contacted. He arrives. It would be like having an establishing scene with Lloyd the ghost bartender in The Shining 15 minutes before he like actually starts serving Jack Torrance a drink, right? Like it's just a cheat. It doesn't work. And that brings me to kind of a second thing here, which is that the movie wears so many cinematic illusions on its sleeve. I mean, it really does feel like Al Capone in the Overlook Hotel, if you transport the Overlook Hotel to Florida, in the swamps of Florida. And there's the whole Wizard of Oz thing, which like just, I think Alyssa's right. There's clearly something very personal here that, you know, that Trank is trying to say about courage and, you know, being true to yourself or whatever.
He's trying to say that Al Capone was in actual jail and he was in director jail, and he feels the same way.
It's a movie that by making Capone like incredibly debilitated and nostalgic totally lets him off the hook for running a massively violent, destructive criminal syndicate. I think we can all agree that Prohibition was bad, but the Chicago Outfit was not like a misunderstood group of like fun guys, right? I mean, they were...
Capone in particular.
Yes. Like, these were really brutal, violent people. And, you know, you can reckon with that and still play Capone is really debilitated, but not the way it works here. I mean, he is, because you literally never see him sort of competent or active at all, and you see the past sort of through his kind of fuzzy imagination, you know, you see his version of himself where he is, you know, you see his sort of dreams, especially all the stuff with him surrounded by children. But it's totally exculpatory in a way that is just kind of a bizarre choice and makes the whole thing really stickily sentimental.
It's not just exculpatory. It's almost worse than that. It just sort of chooses to... It doesn't even try to say, well, he's not to blame or he's not... He didn't do it. It just sort of it completely ignores all of the interesting, relevant history of the individual at the center of the film, of the title character. And it's a movie that's not really about Capone. It's a movie that's about Josh Trank. He didn't make it. He wasn't actually interested in telling us what it was like to be Al Capone in his dotage, you know, in his fading years, as the world collapsed around him, you know, being sad, about his sins, but in some ways unable to recognize them, being abusive to his family, but not really being able to understand or control his behavior. Like, you see that maybe at some point Josh Trank had that thought that that was what this movie was about, but it's not. The movie tells us not one thing about Capone, the actual person.
Do we want to talk a little bit about Josh Trank? Because there was a big piece in Polygon that we read about his you know, rise and fall. And it is kind of interesting in the way that all tragedies are kind of interesting. Like, he bursts onto the scene with Chronicle, which is a huge hit. You know, he is...
And made when he was like 25, 27, something. He came out when he was like 28 years old.
He releases this movie. It's number one at the box office. And, you know, the headlines are all new youngest number one director at the box office supplanting Steven Spielberg. So he's like set up to be this kind of Spielbergian wunderkind type who then takes his time on his next project and decides to make the Fantastic Four reboot with Michael B. Jordan.
Signs a deal to make a Star Wars movie during this time.
Yeah, well, I think that was later. I think that was
it was before Fantastic Four fell apart. It was before it was obvious that it was a disaster that he had signed this deal to make, I believe, a Boba Fett standalone film.
Boba Yaga. Honestly, now I need a John Wick Boba Fett movie. Now that you've done this to my brain, but the
is no good to me dead.
And then he makes this disastrous Fantastic Four movie, and he craps on the film like on Twitter before it's released, and he's like, the movie I made was really good, and the studio messed it up, and blah blah blah. And then he doesn't do anything for about 5 years, and then he makes this movie, Capone. And I'm
not just doesn't do anything, but the things he had lined up to do were taken. Those projects went away. Let's say.
I don't know. What do you guys make of the tale of Josh Trank? Is there anything for us to take away from his follies, or is he like Al Capone's last year, just kind of inscrutable and there, and like, don't be like that?
No, I mean, I have to say, reading that profile, which is by Matt Patches, an entertainment journalist I know a little bit, and like, I felt like it was a really great example of, or perhaps a really great way to explain a point of view that I would not necessarily expect listeners of this podcast to be sympathetic to. But the profile was so sort of self-pitying and went on at just sort of such length and detail, and the movie that it's ultimately pegged to is such a disaster, that it makes me feel like Trank is a great example of sort of the man who gets attention and opportunities that would not be available to a woman who sort of screwed up in the same way. And I mean, I like Chronicle. There's no denying it was a huge hit. But, you know, Trank behaved in ways that were just clearly impossible on the set of Fantastic Four, like refusing to talk to any of his actors. Like, it's a franchise movie, right? I mean, you have to have at least some sense of what to expect. And, you know, the idea that he is worth this much introspection and this cast for this movie is just... The reasoning for it is not in evidence. And, yeah, you know, sometimes when, you know, women complain about, you know, the sort of mediocre white man phenomenon, like, it's overblown or misplaced. But, like, this is an example of the kind of story and career arc that just set so many women's hair on fire, right? Like, it's when women talk about, like, carrying yourself with the confidence of a mediocre white man, it's not like that we look around and think all white men are mediocre or don't deserve what they're doing. It's like this kind of sort of exhaustive exegesis and this kind of opportunity, you know, career rehabilitation opportunity that results in this. And so, yeah, like, you can, for listeners of this podcast who think that formulation is crazy or annoying, like, this is the kind of thing that sets off that reaction. So just,
well, we can revisit this when Kathy Yan gets her next picture.
Totally. I think the lesson is that it's a mistake to push young promising directors, even young promising directors who start with an indie superhero film, into mega budget franchise superhero filmmaking. And that when you go from making Chronicle for, I don't know what the budget was, but it wasn't gigantic. I want to say it was like $10 or $15 million, but it might have been a little more than that. And then the next film somebody makes is $100 million or $150 million and has probably several films riding on it, a future franchise. That's a bad idea. And most 30-year-olds can't handle that. There are probably some, but not very many. And if you want to compare him to another quite young director who I think has fared much better, I think he's had some criticism, but has just made some really good movies. Damien Chazelle, who is
Ryan Coogler,
right? Or Ryan Coogler. And now Coogler ended up making a very good superhero movie, but Damien Chazelle made Whiplash. Was nominated for Best Picture twice, right? With La La Land. I really liked First Man. I thought it was actually a mistake to omit it from the Best Picture nominations. And has just done really well for himself, making somewhat smaller, more personal films that are of the right scale for him to make. And I think you look at La La Land, and it's not a mega movie, but it's actually a big, complex production in terms of all the dancing and all the kind of all the stuff they had to do. He's somebody who could handle a big project, I think, but he has avoided the really giant projects, and I think to his benefit.
Yeah, and Coogler is like almost the opposite, right? I mean, like he made Black Panther, but then before that, he made Creed and he produced Creed 2. I mean,
he made Fruitvale Station, which is an amazing movie.
Well, sure, but that's like his small movie, right? Yeah. And then, like, Coogler actually strikes me as somebody who is, like, actually perfectly well-suited for this sort of thing because that is what he wants.
Yeah.
Like, that is, like, his actual goal is to be the director of, like, franchise fare.
At the same time, my understanding is that his next movie that he's set for is about, like, the Atlanta teachers cheating scandal, right?
Script written by Ta-Nehisi Coates.
His success making Black Panther to do the thing that a lot of directors then fail to do, which is to go off and make
a passion project.
Yeah, a small, deeply personal project that isn't a big superhero film.
Yeah. So what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on Capone?
Save yourselves. Thumbs down.
It's a thumbs down, but I actually think this movie is entrancingly interesting despite being clearly very bad. It's such a weird, fully committed project from both the director and the star that I will say that there's people who will appreciate watching it, even if I don't think many people will think it is actually a good movie.
God, I wish I had a mute button for you. It's a thumbs down because it's bad. And what is annoying to me, and I can already see it happening, and I can hear it right now from Peter Suderman, is that within 5 years, people will try to reclaim this as a camp cult classic masterpiece. And it is actually there. I think there's actually a way to look at this as camp because everybody's being incredibly earnest in this picture. It is a deeply earnest failure, which is like the thing that you need for camp to exist. And people are going to look at that Kyle MacLachlan chewing on the, you know, carrot thing. People are going to throw carrots at the screen, at the retroactive.
No, they're just going to bring their own carrots to chomp on.
Oh, God. I can see the cult forming around this movie already, and I want to burn it down. I want to find all the prints and burn them so nobody can do that.
There's not going to be – the food supply is going to be out of carrots in 5 years, so you don't have to worry.
Thumbs down. All right. Up this week in assigned viewing is Spirited Away. Alyssa, why are we watching Miyazaki's classic anime?
So I love this movie and have loved it since the first time I saw it in college. And I thought it was perfect to watch right now because it is a story about what you do when you find yourself, when you suddenly find yourself in completely alien circumstances with very few resources and have to find a way to cope anyway. And this is, unlike Capone, a profoundly strange movie in a lot of ways. It follows Chihiro, a 10-year-old girl, as her parents are transformed into pigs, and she ends up working as an indentured servitude, as an indentured servant in a bathhouse that caters to members of the Japanese spirit world.
Well, including a radish.
Yes.
A giant radish spirit.
Yes, a giant radish spirit, a number of sentient ducks, a number of river spirits, and she has to remember her own name, sort of reconcile two feuding twin sisters, help break a river spirit out of the spell that's been cast upon him, and also turn her parents from pigs back into human beings. And I have to say, weathering the COVID-19 pandemic is not that onerous or weird, but it's definitely onerous and weird. And it's
same vibe.
Yeah, it struck me as a movie that was sort of useful to revisit at a time when we're all feeling incredibly out of place. And also, this is the first time I've watched this movie since I became a parent. And I had not really thought about that going into this, but it is a movie about what happens when a child is deprived of her parents. And it is both terrifying in that sense to watch it as a parent, because you think about your own kid suddenly being without you in circumstances that defy comprehension, much less navigation. But it's also really heartening and lovely because it's a story about a young person who initially finds the mundane world really overwhelming and hard to navigate, but discovers her own courageousness and competence. And I found that really profoundly moving. I felt like this was the movie that I needed to watch right now. And in addition to all of its just wonderful weirdness, I think it's a sort of spiritually fortifying movie. So I thought I would gift us all that.
Yeah, I hadn't watched it since college. I think this came out when I was in college, 2001 or 2002, somewhere in there.
2001, yeah.
Yeah, and I remember at the time, like, kind of liking it, but not really liking it that much. And rewatching it again was definitely a different experience. And I guess underestimated the first time around just how, like, deeply distressing the movie is. Just, like, kind of like, you know, I mentioned this on Twitter, and someone was like, a friend replied, the pigs traumatized me as a child. But it's not just that. It's like the girl, you know, she's crying herself to sleep after, like, over the last 24 hours, she has moved to a new town. Her parents have been turned into pigs. She's had her name taken away from her by an evil witch. And she's essentially signed up for a lifetime of servitude, right? Like, this is like she has made a series of, you know, choices that some she has made and some have been foisted upon her. But like it is like overwhelmingly terrifying from a child's perspective. But it really is. It is delightfully weird, and I'm glad you mentioned the bit about. I'm glad you mentioned earlier, Alyssa, that like Capone is weird in a way for the sake of being weird, like the little kid with the balloon, you know, and all that stuff. But this is weird. This is weird and alien in part because it's a weird and alien culture to us. Japanese culture is very different than Western culture. It's like the idea of animism and spirits and everything, and, you know, is strange and unusual. So like the idea of essentially a giant radish monster walking around is like on the one hand very unusual, but also makes perfect sense within the logic and universe of the film. It all works. And it is weird and unsettling, but it is meant to be, and it has its own internal logic to it that I think is in a way pleasing.
I think that's the sort of the strong sense of internal logic is what really makes this work. You know, and it one of the things that the movie that Miyazaki does incredibly well is sort of brings you into the world slowly, right? Chihiro and her family stop on this drive to their new house to investigate what at first seems to be an abandoned amusement park. And so you see the architecture, you see all of these sort of animist Japanese statues. And then slowly things get stranger and stranger along the way. So he sort of eases you in so that by the time Chihiro is fully invested in this world, you've sort of gotten accustomed to it. It's almost like an inoculation. But it's also very sweet, right? I mean, as weird as the radish god looks, you know, he's also kind of adorable. You have these like large fluffy ducks. You know, and some of the images that are disturbing, like the no-face creature, Miyazaki over and over finds a sort of tenderness and vulnerability in people who seem scary. There are no outright monsters in this movie. And it's one of the reasons that I think it's bearable as a children's movie instead of completely unbearable.
I had just read the French children's book, The Little Prince, before I watched this. And I was struck in some ways but how some of the carryover of the themes between the book and this movie, the book is in many ways sort of harps on how strange adults are in that they expect things to be clear and like countable and to make sense. And this movie, as you said, has an internal logic. At the same time, it doesn't ever go out of its way to explain it. Things just are the way they are. They're strange and they're odd in whatever way they happen to be. And the movie does a kind of incredible job of showing you what the world looks like through the eyes of a child who doesn't know why things are the way they are. And so you just end up having to accept that sometimes there's a stink monster that comes to your place of business and you have to wash it and have to pull the thorn out of it. And then it turns out not to be a stink monster. And did you guys find yourself reminded of Tom Hardy when watching that stink monster? Because I was like I watched these two movies two nights in a row and it just really felt like, oh my goodness, Tom Hardy is playing. He's not playing Al Capone. He's playing a Miyazaki monster. And there, you know, the kind of spittily, gross, just sort of like drippy weirdness of him and of that particular monster, I thought was sort of interesting. I'm curious, you know, from both of you, we've talked about this as a children's movie. Alyssa, you said it's the first time you've seen it since you became a mom. This movie strikes me as, on the one hand, it has its gentleness to it. It's not like a particularly dark and gritty film. At the same time, compared to an American children's movie, even to a PG-rated Pixar film where there's, you know, moments of death and loss, this is much more, it's just much more graphic. Well, it's much more frightening. Do you guys think that this is an appropriate movie for kids? I mean, at what age do you start showing children a movie like this?
It's interesting because I was tweeting about this and a friend of mine mentioned that her 3-year-old loves this movie. Maybe her kid is 4 now. But and in particular that he likes sort of the turnip god, and she always thinks of the turnip god as kind of cheering her kid on. I don't know that I would not show a kid this young this movie. I would show them a lot of other Miyazaki, particularly My Neighbor Totoro, maybe Howl's Moving Castle, which has some of the same kind of strangeness and sadness. But this one I would probably wait until they were a little older, just in part because a lot of it is visually is just nightmare fuel for a kid who hasn't seen these kinds of images before and doesn't have the cultural
references. The bit where the dragon is bleeding, I mean, it's really kind it is... Again, it's not mean-spirited. It's not gritty,
it's
but
visceral.
It's graphic in a way that you just don't see in American films.
The best comparison I could think is it's like a Roald Dahl.
Yeah. It's very
I think there's a type of child who would be fine watching this at, you know, 6 or 8 or, you know, whatever. And there is a type of child who would definitely not be. But it definitely is like it's a darker, little more sardonic, little more difficult world than I think most children's literature would fall into. I mean, this movie has a very Willy Wonka vibe to it, which is, you know, which is good. I mean, again, I feel like it's the sort of thing that I probably would have liked a lot as like a precocious 7 or 8 year old or whatever, right?
Also, Wizard of Oz and Alice in Wonderland. I mean, Alice in Wonderland in particular, it has that same sort of, like, you've just gone into a nonsense world vibe and you're lost and you're trying to get back home. And Wizard of Oz, again, to a similar extent. I loved it. I mean, and it's, I think in some ways I like it more now than, like you said, Sonny, than when I was in my 20s and I saw it at first.
I also think it just gives a lot of credence to kids, both negative and positive emotions. I mean, one of the things that's, you know, Chihiro's parents don't come across as particularly likable in this movie. They're not super sympathetic to her anxieties about moving. They go on this, you know, sort of side trip that she's anxious about and doesn't really want to go on. You know, it also gives a lot of credence to the idea that she and Haku, who turns out to be the river who saved her when she was a little girl, that there's like real love there, and it's not romantic, but it is really powerfully transporting. And it's simultaneously sort of an age-appropriate depiction of that sort of affection and much more sophisticated than basically any kids' movie ever gives kids sort of romantic friendships for being. It's really, really lovely.
Yeah, I mean, speaking of sophistication, it just struck me how limited American family and children's films. I mean, we praise Pixar correctly, I think. I think this is right for making kids' films that are also, you know, friendly to adults that adults can enjoy on their own. And I certainly, like, I agree with that. At the same time, so many American family films, kids' films, are just these, like, kind of irritating, kind of frantic, kind of, you know, very slapstick, kind of loud and obnoxious movies. You think about, like, the character of the, and I, it's really kind of one character, of the three green heads that sit in the office. And you know that in an American movie, they would be like, you might have those three heads, but they would be voiced like all by Eddie Murphy or something. Yeah. And they would by Gilbert Gottfried, and they would be nothing but like fast talking, you know, joking, right? And they might even be funny, and they might even steal the movie, but they would, but no American film studio would have the sensibility, the courage to just put something quite as weird as like three green heads that don't say words, that just sort of have strange facial expressions and serve
around.
Serve as like an absurdist chorus, you know, almost to kind of comment on the action by the way they stack themselves and the faces that they make.
One thing I'm always aware of as I'm watching a movie like this is that there are so many cultural cues that I'm simply not picking up on. For instance, you mentioned the parents, Alyssa, and that they're not particularly likable or relatable, right? That they're kind of they live in their own little world. But there are all sorts of little markers that suggest to us reasons that we should not like them, right? Like, for instance, the fact that they drive an Audi is a thing I noticed. And as I'm watching this, I'm like, I think that this is a symbol of like either upper class or upper middle class, you know, anxiety, right? That this is a wealthy family. They think they can go and they can just buy the food, right? They show up at this place where they're not invited. They just start chowing down on food at a hut, and they're like, whatever, it doesn't matter, we can pay for it, it's fine. There's a whole like series of kind of class undercurrents here. The monster that wants to give everyone gold, and everyone is freaking out and losing their mind over the gold, right? When this came out, right? So this comes out in 2001. And a few years after the Japanese economy has gone from like roaring success to kind of a disaster. And there are all of these little like cues that are there, but I wonder exactly how they play to a native speaker and how they play in the moment in the culture itself, you know?
Yeah, no, and I mean, thinking of Miyazaki as just sort of this kind of whimsical figure in the United States, I mean, when his movies are obviously engaged with politics and economics and religiosity in a way that doesn't necessarily translate over here. That said, I mean, some of the things that he adapts, like Howl's Moving Castle, is by the, I think, British author, Diana Wynne Jones. So he's not someone who works sort of exclusively in that mode, even though this movie is very obviously very Japanese in a way that not everything single thing he makes is.
Okay. Assigned viewing for next week is going to be Band of Outsiders, courtesy of Peter Sudermann. You can watch it on the Criterion Channel, where it is currently streaming. It's a good excuse to sign up for the Criterion Channel if you have not already. All right, that's it for today's show. Please make sure to check out They Called Me Wyatt by Natasha Tynes, available at Amazon.com. Please go to RebellerMedia.com and sign up for a membership. If you don't sign up, we don't get to keep doing this. And remember, for the next 2 months, it's free. Just click on that little box at the top of the homepage. I don't know how much longer we're going to keep doing this, but it's a pretty good deal. So, if you love the show, tell your friends. A strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. And if we don't grow, we'll die. We're kind of like sharks. Review us at Apple. That also helps with helping people find us. If you didn't love today's episode, complain to me on Twitter at SunnyBunch. I will convince you that it is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys next week.
Across the Movie Aisle is a Rebeller Podcast Network original, hosted by Sunny Bunch, Alyssa Rosenberg, and Peter Suderman. Produced by Sunny Bunch and Natasha Pasetta. Executive Producer Dallas Sonier. Associate Producer Jessica Safavamare. Art and Design by Jason Koslerich. Sound Recording, Design, and Mixing by Sunny Bunch, with music by James Malone.